Let's continue.
Okay, so we started to ask, how can we understand the prohibition of basar b'chalav? Well, we know that the Torah tells us three times, lo sevasha b'di b'chalei v'imo, all in that same language. And yet, it's not apparently all about bishul. At least in one opinion in the Gemara, Rabbi Shmuel, that Rashi quotes. Not the only opinion in the Gemara, but seems to be probably the dominant one. That there are three sort of that are all phrased the same way, even though they are three different, probably related things. There's an Isser Bishul, an Isser of Achila, and an Isser of Hana. And we need to figure out how they relate to each other. And we suggested that the Mishnah is already directing our attention towards one specifically by opening with Bishul. Now, as was pointed out, the Torah itself uses the word Bishul all three times, so maybe the Mishnah is simply using the language of the Torah, or maybe both of them are functioning off the same premise, that there is something special about Bishul. We need to figure that out. And the Mishnah also is taking up the topic. It's even just the first half of the short Mishnah, in the very economic language, of what is included in this Isser. And we will see that the Mishnah is addressing both on the level of Daraisa and the level of Darabana. It's going to be a very important theme to us to understand how they relate to each other. And we'll ultimately see a little bit here and a little bit over the course of the parak that what is included in the prohibition of basar b'chalav, both as far as what is basar, what is chalav, what is one, what is the other, is going to be subject to a lot of debate, and that some things will be included on a level min haTorah, some things will be included on a level midrabanan, and some things will not be included at all. And there's probably some significance, just to look for a moment to practical halacha, sidestepping all the different opinions in the Mishnayos and in the Gemara. So we know that lahalacha, we assume that if you have beef and milk, you're dealing with daraisas. If you have chicken and milk, you're dealing with drabanas. So apparently something that is not the actual intent of the Torah, but has enough overlap that the rabbis felt it had to be prohibited. And if you're dealing with fish and milk, you're not dealing with a prohibition at all. Something that's distinct enough that even on a rabbinical level, it wasn't prohibited. So what do those three different points tell us about how to relate to the intent of the Torah? So with that background, so we started to consider what is the intent of the Torah. What is Bishul Basar B'chalav? What is the whole concept of Basar B'chalav? Presumably it is a chok, as we categorize mitzvos as more or less relatable on some kind of a scale. But can we try to make some kind of effort to try to understand what reasoning might be behind it? So I think that was where we left off. So what possible angle might there be to understand? And if you had a chance to see the Ben Ezra and a few other Rishonim, I didn't necessarily put on the list, but Ben Ezra's a little more accessible. What might be a reasoning behind Basar B'chalav? And the Rishonim do have a number of different speculations. Maury?
Health reasons?
Health reasons. So it's interesting that I actually, not sure if it's among them, but okay. But maybe in general, the concern that maybe kashrus has some connection to health in general is something that the Rambam has dealt with. You know, whether foods that are prohibited are health considerations is something that nowadays we don't find too popular an opinion, at least among Orthodox Judaism. Mm-hmm. But it is something the Rambam considered, but not so much in terms of Basar B'chalav. Yeah, Sam?
Maybe ethically.
Okay, so how...
one animal in that same animal's milk.
Okay, so expand on that. So what do you mean by that?
Well, the phrase of the pasuk, you can't cook a kid in its mother's milk. So, I don't know if it doesn't necessarily, I guess it doesn't have to be necessarily a child and its actual mother, but it seems a little odd, a little messed up, or something like that.
A little odd and messed up.
Yeah.
It's not a direct quote from the Rishonim, but you do...
I don't know how masturbates.
No, okay, but let's try to think about that for a second, because you do find things like that. So let's break down what you said. So first of all, the idea of kid in the mother's milk. So here, just in terms of interpreting psukim, so this, we alluded to this a little bit yesterday. That's a question by itself. Why does the Torah say it like that? Why does the Torah not just say, don't mix meat and milk? So already you could say that two ways. You could say at least two ways. You could say that there's something about that specific context that tells you what the Isser is about. That there's something specifically about a child and the mother being consumed together, or something about them being consumed together, that is problematic for us. Now, we know that lahalacha, there is no distinction, right? Milk from any mother is going to be just as prohibited as from the mother of this animal. Right? We know that lahalacha, we don't mean that. But it might be that that's a technicality, that maybe, like, if you saw the Ibn Ezra writes that really it is about the mother, but the way people purchase milk, you never know where it comes from, so we just had to make across-the-board policy that any milk and any meat, but really it is about the mother. Or you could say, as other Rishonim say, it has nothing to do with this mother and this meat. There's something about milk and meat that they should not be mixed. So why does the Torah talk about milk of the mother? Because we often have an expression sometimes, Dibur HaKasuv Behove, that the Torah will sometimes use to describe a scenario, whatever is the most likely scenario. So you're cooking and you have in your household, you have milk that came from this animal, because that's the animal you have, and now you have a child from that animal that you're going to shecht. So that's what you have accessible. So you're most likely dealing with the milk and the meat from the same family. But it doesn't have to be. It could be any milk and any meat. And nowadays that you're going to supermarkets and you're going to the butcher, so it'll be from anywhere. But deeper across the Torah described it in the way that was most likely, but there isn't anything there that really tells you anything about what the Issa reflects.
I was also just thinking of their mother-child relationship with the Shilach, kind of. Anyway, the mother, like, you can't.
So some of the Rishonim do make this link, right? That the idea that what Yisurim do we have that parallel this? So Shilach again is one of them. Happens to also be a Parak Nechulin, right? Which is also interesting. What else? What other Isser? The Torah was also a Parak Nechulin. Do you have that would mirror that concept? Also, yes, but no, right? There is such an idea that you're not supposed to shecht the animal and the mother in the same day. So maybe there's something there, which some of the Rishonim draw this linkage, that maybe it's just too much. Now, this could all kind of plug in back to the Shechita idea, and I asked you yesterday, that even if we accept that Basa B'chalav is a chok, so is it a chok like Shatnez? Or is it a chok like Shechita? Or is it like, would you get categorized with L'Sigzol, which is a straight Mishpat? You know, so Shechita, we said, on the one hand, it's ritual, and you wouldn't expect non-Jews to perform Shechita kahalacha. But the first parak, we were talking about Shechita, we felt that it's something that's pretty close to accessible understanding, that a lot of the Rishonim understood that Shechita was about the premise that it's the least painful way for the animal to die, and it's connected to Tzar Balei Chaim, and therefore, maybe that's how we relate to it. Now, we mentioned then that there were some who say, how could it be about that? Because when it comes to other times we kill animals, why don't we say that if it's all about killing the animal in the most painless way, so every time you kill an animal, you should have to kill it like that. If you want to kill an animal for tefillin, for Sefer Torah, it should also have to be shechted. We don't find that every single time you kill an animal that we require it to be only in this way. So if it's all about minimizing the pain of an animal that you're killing, why don't we require it across the board? Right? So we discussed that it might be a combination of things. It might be that, yes, ideally we would always try to minimize the pain of an animal. But especially together with the whole idea of eating meat, which itself maybe is somewhat of an indulgence or is somewhat of a extra license. So together with that, we also want to couple it with a greater concern to make sure you're doing it in as respectful and painless a way as possible. So too, maybe a concern like Bas Mechalav is saying that once you're eating meat, there's still a certain restraint that has to be brought into it. And whether it's a restraint just in your own personal behavior, or whether it's a display of achzarias that you're trying to avoid. That's how, for example, the Ibn Ezra puts it. Right? That it just seems cruel to be not only eating this little animal, the gedi, right, that which many of the Rishonim understood, that a gedi specifically connotes a young animal. So not only are you eating this child, so to speak, this young animal, but you're doing so kind of achis, you know, with its mother's milk, this extra shtach, so to speak. So maybe there is something cruel about that. Now, there's a whole discussion to be had, and there's some who point out that we don't necessarily mean that you're inflicting any greater suffering on the animal one way or another, but that often the concern is for you, that we don't want to do anything that will allow greater achzarius to be formed, greater personal cruelty to be formed in other ways. So we're always worried about our own sensitivity. So when it comes to Tzar Balei Chaim, we also find that there's a two-tiered concern, that we don't want animals to suffer for no reason. But we're also concerned that the imposition of suffering on animals is something which engenders cruelty in the human being who's doing it. So here, Sadha Bechor Shor, for example, comments that it could be that we're focused on not allowing the individual to become desensitized, to have this somewhat cruel approach to eating be a part of their mentality, and therefore we have such a mindset. So far, so good. Any other approaches that you could take to this issue? So it could be that it's about some kind of cruelty, or it could be that it's about some kind of gluttony, as some of the Rishonim have, like the Rashbam has, that it's a Rav Sanusa, it's just too much. Some understand that essentially it's a problem of mitamte mesalev, that non-kosher food, we have a tradition that we spoke about last month also, we got into the discussion of behemten shel tzadikim about not even inadvertently consuming non-kosher food. Also a topic in last week's Parsha, for in Parsha Shmos, when we have this tradition that Moshe Rabbeinu was nursed by his mother, Bedavka, because even a baby should only be nursed from somebody who eats only kosher food. So the notion of Metamte Mesalev, so some of the Rishonim have the idea that milk is essentially blood, and that it's like consuming blood. Now, why don't we say that milk then is problematic? Because it changes form by then. But that's when it's separated from the meat. But when it's put back together with the meat, so then that's essentially making it back in its bloody form. And therefore, it's metamte mesalev. And maybe that's closer to what Maury was saying in terms of the health consideration. That's a spiritual timtum. Yes, sir.
That's similar to the. I mean, it seems to be, you know, similar to the mitzvah that we saw earlier, which
maybe there's a, I think quoting Betisigev, and just something we're bringing from the Russian, do you want?
Now that there's particular sensitivity to Machalos Asuras.
Right. But
that more than other Isurim, that eating is more dangerous.
I was curious if we wanted to, would we extend the Sefer Pinyan Svara of just touching upon the different given reasons for why we might, or the purposes of Shkita, we saw the Sefer Pinyan to understand it as just being the best way to remove blood.
One of them, right? The Sefer HaChinuch also mentions that
the
humane component, but also that connected. So that's also a common element here. So if we want to connect this to Shechita, the whole theme of the whole Masechta, what makes this parak fit in this Masechta? Well, it's all about kashrus and meat, but maybe even more fundamentally, so it's all a part of a general sensitivity that's needed while eating meat. And maybe in this a side angle that avoiding eating blood, which is also about sensitivity on a certain level, about avoiding a certain barbarism and a certain mentality of kind of enjoying the fact that you are consuming the life force of something else. So avoiding eating blood is a major focus. So we saw that Shechita also has that component. The assumption is that killing an animal in that way is A, the most painless, but B, also the way most likely to drain the greatest amount of blood. So here, if that's also brought into the discussion, that also kind of links Basa B'chala
B'shchita. Mayor? Blood's not Asur B'Hanah, though.
Correct. So the nature of the Isur Hanah is something we also have to look at. And we'll kind of really get to that probably a little bit next week, which is an interesting question, how exactly that fits in. Okay, so these are some of the possibilities, and it's interesting also to consider, I think we started to mention yesterday, the Sefer HaChinuch, that the Sefer HaChinuch sees it as something in the vein of Shatnez, and we had a little back and forth here, is that helpful or not, or is that just a reframing of the question? So say Shatnez itself a chok, so just put it in that category, but that doesn't really tell us very much. So maybe, but it's a step to say that there's something inherently incompatible about meat and milk in a somewhat more ironic sense, because they come from the same item. So the cow is providing both the meat and the milk, but there is something, like imagine somebody who wants to put the icon on their fleishik drawer and the milchik drawer, so they put a cow on each. It doesn't really help. Right, so you have milk and meat, they both come from the same place, but there is something fundamentally incompatible about them. You know, some point out the fact that the meat has to come from a dead animal, and of course, Alpi Halacha has to be from a dead animal, and that's something that's true even for Bnei Noach. And milk comes from a living animal. We had a little bit of a discussion last semester briefly about whether it's possible to milk a dead animal. A whole question about whether the milk of a nevela would be prohibited. But for the most part, the milk is from a living animal, and the meat is from a dead animal. And there are some who point to that imagery of mixing death and life, that that's something that we fundamentally keep apart. Maybe?
Is there any reason in the first half of each of the three psukim that Los Vashal Gadiva Chalevimo is part of? Because I don't remember exactly how each one starts, but I know that.
Let's start with the first one. Let's say in the Shvatzim. So what's going on there?
Look it up.
I
just know that there's usually a reason why stuff is in the same pasuk.
Correct. So it might be relevant. So there, the pasuk actually talks about Bikurim, but right before that, it's talking about the Regalim. So some of the Rishonim say that it's talking about the Regalim because that's when there's a lot of meat around. That's when there's a lot happening, there's karbanos, there's partying. So it's a good time to mention, by the way, here's how this should be done. But there's also a striking opinion of the Rambam, The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim has an opinion which is somewhat controversial, and maybe it's not the same as his view that prohibited animals have health considerations, but it's somewhere in the middle. That the Rambam says it could be that maybe this is because of an idolatrous practice. That when it comes to this concern, maybe it was that there was a group of Ovdei Avodah Zarah who, even in the Rambam's time, 1,000 years ago, was almost 1,000 years ago, was already ancient history. That they would worship their god by mixing meat and milk. Yes, sir.
Why that specifically? Like, there are a lot of different ways that people worship Avodah Zarah.
And a lot of times we're not letting
you do this. Right, so, but I think what Mayor's asking is that, which is a fair question too, but it's not necessarily conclusive, that we have generally certain, the Torah tells us, and we know things that are connected to Avodah Zarah, so if something is identifiably idolatrous, so then it's already prohibited. So why, I think what you're asking is, why does the Torah have to single out certain behaviors?
I mean, you're not doing it for Avodah Zarah, so it wouldn't be prohibited.
So,
I'm just asking, why would this specific thing be singled out?
So it's a fair question, but it won't be the only thing. We have other things in the Torah which also seem to be, for example, maybe cutting a payas might be connected to things like that. We have certain activities which are prohibited, it sounds like, either explicitly or not so explicitly, because of their connection to the practices of Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Now, your point. Sorry?
Like making an image, like statue of like any like life form. Like,
right, although that's more direct, though, because there you understand the concern you'll come to worship that. So here, I think what Mayer's asking is okay, but here you have just some kind of random practice which happens to be associated with a specific group that would choose that as an idolatrous thing. Why prohibit that any more than anything else than any other group does? That's a fair question, although it doesn't necessarily rule out its possibility, because we do find that. The Rambam is controversial for other reasons. Remember discussing this once with Wojtyski, who we heard from this morning, that you know, there's always a concern that when you peg a mitzvah to anything transient, you know, to anything connected to one point in history, that could lead one to think, okay, so it's not relevant nowadays. And it's interesting that the Rambam's comfortable doing this here, because I think I mentioned yesterday, right, that Bas V'Chalav is one of the most relevant mitzvos to us in terms of daily life. It affects pretty much every day of your life. The question, am I fleishik now, am I milchik now, did I use the right dish, did I use the right fork? It affects a decision that you make every day of your life, the whole concept of separating meat and milk. It's so fundamental to practice, so it's a little hard to swallow the idea that all of this should be because we're avoiding the practice of some idolatrous cult that hasn't been around for a very long time and has no connection to our lives in 2020. So there are those who would be uncomfortable with that. Like I said, Rabbi Tversky, I discussed with him, he felt that this was, despite the fact that it's coming from the Rambam, is a very difficult position to be okay with, to comfortably connect to something like Basu B'Chalav. And that this is a part of the controversy surrounding some of the writings of the Rambam, that this is an approach that others wouldn't necessarily feel is a comfortable approach to a question like this.
Where was the Rambam?
Rambam is in Mor Nevuchim. I can give you the exact place to look at. So, in any event, what does that give us? It gives us a range of how to look at what Bas V'Chalav is about. On the one hand, let's say take the extremes. We could take the most mystical approach, or the most super rational approach, and say it's a chok gomer. It's beyond us. We have no way to understand at all what it's about. And we should note that even a lot of the Rishonim who offered some of the theories that we mentioned today said it could be this, it could be that, but at the end of the day, it seems like it is a sod or a chok that we don't really know what it's about. So on one end of the spectrum, we have that. On the other end of the spectrum, we have the Rambam that we just mentioned, who really rooted it in something very, or thought maybe it was rooted in something very specific and very limited, perhaps. And in the middle, we have a number of theories that see some kind of an ethically relatable component, whether it's about cruelty, whether it's about gluttony, whether it's about restraint, or maybe in the Sefer Achinuch, a somewhat more abstract idea of incompatible opposites, like shatnez, that might be relevant here as well. So all of this is helpful for us to keep in mind as we think about some of these sugyas, partially because some of the lamdusha questions probably reflect various possibilities here. So, for example, one question to keep in mind as we see some of the sugyas, for example, as the Ragachover phrased it, is Basu B'chalav about the combination of two otherwise innocent parts, Basar and Chalav, coming together? Or is it about one messing up the other? Is it about not eating Basar in a certain way? Or is it about not eating Chalav in a certain way? Which may impact on some of the understandings. And we'll see. For example, if the basar meets a certain definition but the chalav doesn't, or if the chalav meets a certain definition but the basar doesn't, is one part of this equation more important than the other? That's something that we'll see is going to come up a lot. And also, a notion that's going to be very relevant also is the idea that we find that Basu B'chalav Chiddush Hu. That Basu B'chalav is something distinct. A Chiddush, when we talk about it in classical literature, we don't mean a Chiddush like we say nowadays, oh, that's an interesting new idea. Well, what's the classical definition of a Chiddush? Jack?
Since it was defies general way the Torah works?
Correct, right? Or basically a Chiddush, a Davar, a Soser, a Saklau, right? Something that contradicts any kind of general rules. So sometimes we have things we feel are more logical and systematic, and that we can apply some general principles to them. And sometimes we have halachos which seem to stand outside the systems, and they're referred to as a chiddush, something that does not fit normal rules. So basar b'chalav is often treated as a chiddush, so we'll have to keep that in mind. What does that mean, it's a chiddush? And why should it transcend other policies that you might find in the realm of machalas asuris? And on the surface, the reason it's a chiddush is because it seems like, why should it be that two substances that by itself are each apparently relatively innocent, that somehow the combination creates a problem? Why should that be? You know, it's easy to understand that if a little bit of pork falls into my chicken soup, okay, I see what the problem is, that I got pork in my chicken soup, the pork is bad. But if a little bit of milk falls into my chicken soup, why is that an issue? If the milk is fine by itself and the chicken soup is fine by itself, why is the milk and the chicken soup together a problem? What's the logic of that? So is it that it transcends logic and therefore we have to see it as a chiddush? So keep that in mind. That's more of a long-term issue in this parak. What exactly are the implications of seeing Basu B'chalav as a chiddush? It's something that's going to come up a lot. And now to plug it into our more direct issue here in the Mishnah and in the Psukim. So what is the relationship between Bishul and the other Isurim? And this is a somewhat complex question. So the relationship between Hana and Achila is an interesting question, which we won't get to today. Maybe next week. But first, let's consider just Bishul and Achila. That's our immediate agenda right now. What is the relationship between the prohibition of Bishul and the prohibition of Achila? And here, maybe you've gotten a little bit of a sense from some of the Makoros that you may have seen. So what would you suggest as possibilities? There are at least two possibilities. You could formulate them in different ways, but there should be at least two distinct ways of considering this relationship. What would you suggest, the relationship between the two? Any thoughts? Yeah, it's
so
you. Sorry? Okay, so what would you do with that? Yeah.
Once we know the visuals up there,
uh-huh.
The Arisa, then you can't. That is, I think, inherently Televa.
Okay.
Is there automatically a Bachila?
Okay, so if you tell me if this is what you're getting at, right? So you're making a reference to Gemara, which we happen to have also seen last semester because it came up in a different context, right? That Gemara has a phrase towards the end of this parak that Lo Sochol Kol Toeva, that we should not eat something which is labeled as a toeva, as a disgusting thing. Where it says, Kol she'ti'avti l'cha harayu bal toichol. Now, I should mention that particular formulation might only reflect a different opinion other than the one that says all three surim come from Los Vashagun. But either way, right, that maybe what we're saying is that there's something inherently wrong about cooking basar b'chol. Maybe that is what we're really upset about. There's something toevidic, there's something unnatural about mixing, creating the combination of milk and meat. So perhaps, for example, out of the different explanations that we said, maybe this is most compatible with the Sefer Achino. Right, that it's like the creation of meat and milk is inherently what bothers us. There's something wrong about that. About fusing milk and meat together. Now, once that's the case, because of this general idea that you shouldn't eat something which is labeled a toeva, so it's also wrong to eat it. But the real issue is, it shouldn't have been created. And if that's the case, it fits well with the fact that that's the language the Torah repeatedly uses. And it fits well with the fact that that's what the Mishnah starts off with. What do we really care about? We really care about not mixing meat and milk in creation of such a unit. But once we want to stigmatize that, so therefore we also are not going to eat it. But it's really about that. It's really about the creation. Which also, in a sense, fits with Shechita. Right? Really, there's no difference between eating meat that has been shechted and eating meat that has been killed in any other way. But what we really want to focus on is that the killing of the animal should be done in this particular fashion. And the way for that to become real is to not only say that the animal has to be shechted this way, but if the animal wasn't shechted this way, you're not allowed to eat that animal. Right? Even though really eating an avela, eating an animal that hasn't been shechted, you would say, well, what's the difference? I can't shecht it now. I can't undo its pain. But nonetheless, that's what gives actual significance to the core concept. The core concept is about how you shecht it, but it's only going to have real impact if we say you can't eat it otherwise. So maybe so too here. It's about not creating basar b'chol, But as a consequence of that, you're not allowed to eat it. And the Gemara we saw last semester, the Gemara was asking, it's interesting that by Torah law, Shabbos is not that way. That by Torah law, if somebody were to be Machal Shabbos, and so let's say cook something on Shabbos, it would not be prohibited to eat that food. And it was up to Chazal to come and to prohibit it, and the Gemara understood that from a pasuk, and we had a whole discussion why that is. What does that reflect about Shabbos or about any related concept? So that's one way to understand it. Right? This way, for example, the Marcheshes, it's a relatively recent sefer, 20th century sefer, the Marcheshes, was written by Reb Chenech Egish. Chenech Egish was the Rav of Vilna. Took over after Reb Chaim Ozer passed away. This was not so long ago, in the 1940s. So the Sefer Marcheshes, he says that's the idea, that the creation of Bishul Basar V'Chalav is an abomination, and therefore it's not right to eat it. So that is one way to relate to it. What's another possible way to relate to this relationship? How else might you look at it? Which may even have a stronger basis, perhaps, in earlier sources. Right, you saw the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah. Right, what is the, so it becomes a little difficult. But the Kesef Mishnah has a couple of ways of looking at this, but the key line in the Kesef Mishnah that I wanted you to appreciate is that the Kesef Mishnah says something very interesting. Kesef Mishnah, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, he writes that the prohibition of Bishul Basar B'Chalav is there. Why? Because you're not supposed to eat Basar B'Chalav. So what's a good way to keep you from eating Basar B'Chalav? Don't make it in the first place. If you don't create the combination of basar v'chalav, that's a good safeguard to keep you from eating basar v'chalav. And conversely, it seems pretty risky to cook basar v'chalav if we understand that you shouldn't be eating it. So it seems like a bad thing to create, and especially once it's there, the aroma, the cheeseburger, or whatever it is, it seems so appealing. So it seems like a pretty bad idea to make such a thing if indeed the Torah prohibited it.
Not enough.
Sorry?
Not enough.
So Hana, again, we'll discuss separately. So for now, let's just look at the relationship between Bishul and Achila.
This is different because this is viewing Achila as the eager.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the other way. But this way may be even a little more likely because it just has some earlier sources to back it up. But essentially, this Kesef Mishnah is very significant. That what the Kesef Mishnah is saying is that really all the Torah is focused on is not eating Basar B'Chalav. Now we saw today that some of the theories in the Rishonim were focused on the eating experience. It shouldn't be gluttonous. It shouldn't be cruel. So maybe that's really what it's about. It's not about the cooking. It's about the eating. But in order to keep us one step removed from that, so the Torah said that you're not even allowed to create it. So this is a fascinating concept, both specifically and generally. And this is going to get us into a broader discussion. So just to give a sentence of introduction. So the veterans know that we make many references to a great Talmudist who died exactly 100 years ago. His 100th Yahrzeit was a few weeks ago. Rav Yosef Engel. Rav Yosef Engel of Poland was a great Gaon, and one of his major, he made many, many, many contributions to Torah literature, But one of his most often quoted pieces is in a Sefer Lekach Tov, and in Klal Ches, in the eighth essay in the Sefer Lekach Tov. You can look this up, it's available online and everywhere else. So Lekach Tov, he has an essay. He says, do you ever find, the title of the essay is, I Matzinu Siag Min HaTorah. This is a part of why I want to get into this on Sunday in terms of Dinim Drabanan. That we know that we have a relationship between Torah law and rabbinic law. That we assume Torah law is basically inherent. The Torah is telling us to do good things and stay away from bad things. Or do good things and don't do bad things. And for the most part, rabbinic law we perceive as being protective. So the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, esyos siag l'Torah, you should make a fence for the Torah. So that's what the rabbis did. They protected the Torah by making extra safeguards. So Rav Yosef Engel posed the question. He says, is that only in rabbinic law? Or is it possible that this is not an absolute distinction? You know, is it that the Torah laws, those are all inherent, and the rabbis, they made the laws that are a step removed? Or is it possible that even in the Torah itself, you have rules that are there as a protection for something else? So Yosef Engel was a Gaon who knew all of Torah in his footsteps, in his fingertips. So he has a lot of pieces like this where he says, has it ever come up? And he says, yeah, here's 35 times where it happens. Remember, I was discussing this once with Rabbi Taubes mentioned. So how come whenever you reverse the angle has a list of something? So it's never in any order. So why is that? Because this is like how it came to him. So, oh yeah, there's this, there's that. So, you know, presumably here also, so he has a list there of where do you find that there are dinim in the Torah itself that are protections for other dinim. And he has a long list. Pretty much everything on the list is all according to one opinion of Rishonim or the other. It's hard to find things that are absolute according to everybody. But he has a long list of, if you say like this view, you say like that view, then this is there as a protection. So one of the things, he quotes this Kesef Mishnah. Says the Kesef Mishnah, Hilchos Tumas Meis, that the purpose of Bishul Basar B'Cholav is it's a Gezeira Min HaTorah. That it is a Din Min HaTorah. No one would deny that there's a Torah prohibition in cooking Bishul Basar B'Cholav. We're not suggesting that it's rabbinic. Everyone understands it's for sure a Torah prohibition. But the nature of that Torah prohibition may be just to prevent a different Torah prohibition. That maybe there is such a concept even within Torah law. That there is a distinction between prohibitions in the Torah itself. Some of them are the thing, and some of them are to protect the thing. So maybe that's what happens here. That the issue is you should not eat basar b'chalav. But there's another prohibition in the Torah, don't cook basar b'chalav, because one could lead to the other. So it's the Kesef Mishnah who spells that out, but there are many who point out that it sounds like the Rambam himself does say this. The Rambam more locally in Hilchos Machalos Asuras, I put this on the list also, that it sounds like, you could read this different ways, but many read the Rambam this way, that the Rambam says, Lo shasak ha-kasav, why was the Torah silent on the issue of achila? Why does the Torah never use the phrase, don't eat basar b'chalav? So says the Rambam, because you can figure it out. It's pretty obvious that if the Torah said, don't cook basar b'chalav, it's basically saying, oh my gosh, don't even come close to eating basar b'chalav. So I certainly don't have to tell you not to eat basar b'chalav. So that phrasing in the Rambam is a little less explicit than the Kesef Mishnah. But there are some who understand that phrasing in the Rambam to be this point. that essentially he's saying that the Torah is prohibiting eating basa b'chalav, and it's so concerned about you eating basa b'chalav that it said, don't come close to eating it, don't even cook it in the first place. And certainly you should understand that we don't want you to eat it. So that is a fascinating possibility. Now, does it matter? Jordan's about to ask, like, does it matter? I can see it as feeling, does it matter? What would you think? Does it matter?
I think probably it does, because, I mean, usually the kicker is, like, the reason behind something. So,
right.
I don't know if the ikar zechila may be, like, different dinim that have to do with that.
So, it's interesting. So here there's a little bit of a baffling phenomenon. So I'll just mention this point, and we'll have to get into the details the next time we get back to the sugya. But I would have thought, were it not for thousands of pages of literature, that, I mean, were it not for quite a lot of written words, that it shouldn't matter. Because we have a rule in general that ein dorshin taima dekra, that it's not up to us, machlokes in the Gemara, but that we spent some time today talking about Tamei HaMitzvos. Right? So we spent a few minutes or half our time today talking about why is a mitzvah there. And it's an interesting question, what role does that play in halacha? It's a part of Talmud Torah. It's a part of our relationship with Chachmas HaTorah. But does it matter? So a part of why we were talking about it, one part is because a part of how it helps us appreciate and understand the sugyas. But also we were suggesting that maybe the drashos in Chazal may correlate to a certain extent to a certain understanding of what it's about. But beyond that, beyond the page, do we ever have the right to say, well, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, I think it's because of A, B, and C, and therefore I'll decide halacha based on that assumption. So normally we would think the answer is no. We would normally say ein dorshin taima dekra, that we're not at liberty to theorize what a mitzvah is about and to make halachic distinctions based on that. We do theorize what a mitzvah is about because it contributes to our understanding of the Torah and our relationship to it. That's why we spent that time on it today. But to make our own halachic distinctions, I would have thought that that's not within our right. However, as we'll see next time, there's a pretty extensive literature that does work with that premise, that it makes a difference. I'm aware of at least one lone voice in the wilderness that said it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, it's a Torah prohibition. It's not up to us to decide it's about this or about that to make any difference. But you'll find many more voices that took the opposite approach, and that said that once we assume that bishul is because of achila, it may make a difference, and it may impact the halacha, and that's what we will start with next time. So just to quickly recap what we spoke about, so we considered different theories as to what bishul basa b'chalav or achilas basa b'chalav is about, and how that may impact why the halacha, at least on a chazal level, develops the way it does. Whether it's a complete chok, whether on the other hand it's connected, on the other extreme it's connected to a specific Ovdei Avodah Zarah cult, whether in the middle it's got ethical considerations such as Rav Sanusa or Achzarius or the impact of Achzarius, or more mystically oriented, the combining of two things that are incompatible, maybe because of symbolism, life or death, or maybe all of that is only speculative and it's essentially a chok. And then we said these will impact questions such as how we define basar, how we define chalav, and the like, and also the concept of basar b'chalav as a chiddush, which itself impacts things, is also going to be connected to this question. And then we brought that into the discussion of, we have three isurim here, bishul, achil, and hana. Achil and hana we'll talk about later, but bishul and achil, let's say, how do they relate to each other? We mentioned two possibilities. One is that the suggestion of Kol Shetiavtu B'Chareu B'Bal Tocho tells us that really Bishul is the issue. It's wrong to combine Bishul. It's wrong to combine Basa B'Chalav. Maybe that's in sync with the Sefer Achinuch kind of approach. And once it's wrong to do that, so you're not allowed to eat it either, which would kind of parallel it well to Shechita and things like that. Once it's wrong to kill an animal non-Shechita-wise, it's wrong to eat such an animal. And other related concepts. But we also saw it could be the other way around, that really it's about achila, we're not supposed to eat this, and if we're not supposed to eat it, so then we shouldn't create it in the first place. And that was the explicit possibility suggested by the Kesef of Mishnah, and then he thought that the Rambam himself really essentially says that, that that says his language of saying it's Kavul Homer from Bishul, and that that could have its own significance to it, and we then put that in the context of Rav Yosef Engel's list, the idea of the whole concept of the Gzeirah D'oraisa. And what we'll have to take from here is, could that actually impact the halacha as discussed beyond the Gemara page? So that's we will pick up from there. All right, so again, tomorrow we'll have an early shiur because of our Levaya, and I wish everyone a